Welcome to the Deep Dive. We grab your sources, pull out the key insights, maybe some surprising facts, and basically give you a shortcut to getting genuinely up to speed on something important. And today, wow, we're diving into something that feels both really old and cutting edge at the same time. It's this old idea in cancer research called the Warburg effect.
Right, Otto Warburg.
Exactly, and how it's inspiring a new approach to treatment that is incredibly low cost.
Yeah.
And it's definitely stirring things up.
It really is. And for this deep dive, we've got a few key sources. There's a New York Times piece for context, a clinical safety study, and a case study too, both from the journal Cancer Medicine.
Yep.
And we've also got some quite candid comments from the research team themselves from a YouTube video they did.
Great. So our mission today is pretty clear, right? We want to unpack this Warburg-inspired treatment, look at the evidence from these sources on its safety, and really focus on its affordability, which is frankly kind of stunning.
It is.
And then tackle that, you know, that big question that jumps out from all this. Why hasn't it gone through those massive, super expensive clinical trials we usually hear about? Despite seeming promising and being so cheap, it really does shine a light on the economics of medical research.
Definitely. Okay, so let's start with the man himself, Otto Warburg, early 20th century German biochemist, Nobel laureate. I mean, a giant, nominated for the Nobel Prize something like 47 times.
47 times? Seriously,
that's
persistence. So what was his big discovery about cancer?
Well, Warburg was obsessed with how cells make energy. And back in the 1920s, he noticed something really strange about cancer cells. They just devour glucose blood sugar way, way more than normal cells.
Okay, they're hungry.
Very. But here's the kicker. Even when there's plenty of oxygen around, which normal cells use for efficient energy production, you know, respiration, cancer cells mostly rely on fermentation to break down that glucose.
So wait, they could use oxygen efficiently, but they choose not to. They just guzzle sugar and use this less efficient fermentation process. It sounds like having a fancy sports car, but only ever letting it idle.
That's a great analogy, yeah. They're incredibly wasteful with the glucose, but they consume tons of it, turning it into lactic acid. That whole phenomena, high glucose uptake, fermentation, even with oxygen, that is the Warburg effect.
And it's common.
Oh, yeah. Estimates are up to 80% of cancers show this effect. It's pretty fundamental.
You mentioned it connects to something we use now.
Absolutely. You know PET scans? Positron emission tomography.
Sure, for detecting cancer.
Well, they work because of the Warburg effect. They use a radioactive sugar substitute. The areas that gobble up the most sugar, the tumors doing the Warburg thing, they light up right on the scan.
Huh. So a standard diagnostic tool is built right on this century-old idea. That's genuinely surprising. But the New York Times article said his work kind of fell out of favor for a long time.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
After Watson and Crick figured out DNA in the 50s, cancer research just pivoted hard. It became all about genes, mutations. Cancer was seen as a genetic disease, period.
Right.
And the NYT article called it a stampede towards genetics. Metabolism, Warburg's whole area, it just got pushed aside, left out of textbooks for decades, actually.
So gene mutations were the whole story. And how cells actually fueled themselves was sort of irrelevant.
Mm.
But that's changing.
Thankfully, yes. The last decade, maybe a bit more, there's been this big Warburg revival. Scientists are looking at metabolism again with much better tools and a slightly different perspective.
How so?
Well, the thinking now isn't so much that messed up metabolism causes the cancer, like Warburg initially thought. It's more that cancer cells hijack these metabolic pathways, like the Warburg effect, specifically to fuel their crazy fast growth.
Okay. So the metabolic shift isn't the spark. It's more like the accelerant that the cancer cell uses to spread. They become, like that researcher said in the article, addicted to nutrients.
Exactly right. And this isn't just theory. You've got top researchers like Craig Thompson at Sloan Kettering, Qi-Van Dang at UPenn, showing that major cancer genes like AKT and MYC, they don't just tell cells to divide. They also directly control how much nutrient the cell takes in and how it uses it.
So genetics and metabolism are totally intertwined, not separate issues at all.
Precisely. They feed into each other. Mm-hmm. And that connection, that metabolic addiction, well, maybe that's an Achilles heel we can target. Starve the cancer cells, basically.
Which brings us to this actual therapy approach, the Warburg therapy or Warburg protocol that the sources describe. Developed by this team, Pei Wah Liu, Tom Tsang, Michael Badowski, and others, directly using Warburg's idea, right? Limit the glucose.
Spot on. That's the core idea.
Okay, so walk us through it. How does it work based on those cancer medicine studies?
It's conceptually quite simple. Patients fast overnight, so their blood sugar is already low. Then they get IV insulin. And this is key. It's specifically to induce hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, for a controlled short period.
How low and for how long?
The target range is typically between 40 and 60 mgDL, and they maintain that for usually about 40 to 60 minutes, just a defined window.
Okay, deliberately causing low blood sugar. That immediately raises safety questions. What did that big clinical safety study find? That seems critical.
Absolutely the first question. And that study in cancer medicine is pretty detailed. It looked at 251 patients, all with advanced cancers, and documented what happened over a lot of treatments, 8,542 individual sessions.
8,500 treatments. Wow. That's a solid base for looking at safety. So the risks.
The headline finding, it was consistently well tolerated. The study reported zero serious irreversible problems caused by the low blood sugar. No shock, no major brain injury, no deep comas, no deaths linked to the hypoglycemia across all those treatments.
Okay, zero serious irreversible events across over 8,000 treatments. That's significant. That really addresses the main worry about inducing hypoglycemia.
It does. They also reported no acute side effects or lasting ones that needed hospitalization, either from the low sugar itself or from the chemo drugs they use alongside it.
Which are given during that low sugar window, right?
Exactly. Very low, sometimes called subroutine. Doses of standard chemo drugs like Fluorouracil or cyclophosphamide are given intravenously right when the blood sugar is at its lowest. Then afterwards, they bring the blood sugar back up with IV glucose or just giving the patient food.
Got it. So no hospitalizations needed for side effects. What about milder stuff? People must feel something when their blood sugar drops like that.
Oh, sure. Mild symptoms were common, noted in about 58% of treatments. Things like sweating, feeling your heartbeat faster, maybe feeling quite sleepy. But the study emphasizes these were always low grade, and crucially, they completely reversed as soon as blood sugar went back to normal.
Okay, so temporary discomfort potentially, but manageable and short-lived. What about overall health? Vitals. Wait.
Yeah, vitals like heart rate, blood pressure generally stayed stable. Any small changes resolved quickly. And here's something that really stands out, especially compared to traditional chemo. Most patients either maintained their weight or actually gained weight during the therapy.
That is different. Weight loss is so common with standard chemo. What about blood work? Did the low-dose chemo trash their immune systems?
Apparently not. The study tracked things like white blood cell counts, liver function, kidney function. Generally, they stayed in normal ranges. And for patients who started out with abnormal levels, those often improved over the course of treatment. It really suggests those low chemo doses weren't causing the kind of systemic damage or severe immune suppression you can see with higher dose regimens.
Okay, so let's pull that safety data together. Based on over 8,000 treatments in patients with advanced cancer, the study's conclusion is that this approach is clinically feasible and safe for repeated use. That feels like a strong takeaway on the safety front.
It certainly does. And that safety profile looks even better when you pair it with the other major point from these sources, the cost.
Right, the affordability. This is where the numbers just get
They're
wild.
Yeah, they really do. The safety study gives some context. Standard chemo in the US, some newer drugs can run, what, $24,000 a month? Even older drugs in standard regimens might be $27,000 for a 6-month course.
Okay, tens of thousands. Ballpark. Now, what about the Warburg therapy? A course of treatment, say 10 sessions over a month or two. What's the cost for the actual supplies?
According to that study, $140. $140 for the infusion supplies for 10 treatments. Obviously, that's on top of routine monitoring, doctor's time, etc., but the core supplies, $140.
$140 versus potentially tens of thousands
It
per course. That is just a staggering difference.
It's huge. And the sources point out the real-world implications. Cancer costs are bankrupting families worldwide. This therapy, because it was so cheap, was actually supported by China's poverty alleviation program. It made treatment accessible for low-income patients who just couldn't afford anything else.
So, okay. We have a therapy that a major study indicates is feasible and safe, even with the hypoglycemia aspect. It uses known approved drugs and costs peanuts compared to the standard, which brings us right to that massive elephant in the room. Why hasn't this gone through the giant multi-billion dollar, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials we expect for new cancer treatments.
And this is where the sources, especially that YouTube video with the researchers, are incredibly direct. They flat out say, no, we haven't done those kinds of trials.
And their reasons, what do the sources say?
They lay out a few key points. First, they argue it might not even be strictly required from a regulatory standpoint, particularly for palliative care uses. Their logic is they're using insulin, Florisil, cyclophosphamide drugs that are already approved, and they're using them at dosages that are also already approved for other things.
So they're not introducing some brand new molecule that needs proving from scratch. They're repurposing approved tools in a new way.
Exactly. And that leads directly to what they identify as the biggest roadblock, the one the sources really hammer home. There is absolutely zero profit motive for big pharma.
Right.
These are old drugs, they're off patent, generics are available. A company can't patent this combination protocol. So why would they spend potentially billions on massive trials for something they can't make significant money from? The whole system, they argue, is geared towards developing expensive new patentable drugs.
Right.
That's where the investment goes.
Wow. That's a pretty stark commentary on how medical research gets funded and prioritized. It suggests that if something is potentially effective but cheap and unpatentable, it could just languish because the economic engine isn't there to push it forward through the standard, very expensive approval process.
That's precisely the implication. They also talk about just sort of systemic resistance or bias against treatments that don't come through that established expensive pipeline, even if the individual components are well known.
Mm-hmm.
The team's message in that video was pretty clear. They feel the system needs to find ways to support inexpensive options, that people in charge should be helping everyone, not just those who can afford the latest, priciest treatments. They said they'd welcome large trials, but they just didn't have the funding themselves, and they didn't feel it was legally essential given the use of approved drugs.
It's a fascinating bind, isn't it? A potentially safe, ultra-affordable therapy using familiar tools hits this wall, mainly because it doesn't fit the financial model of drug development. Let's shift back slightly. How do they think it works? And what benefits do they actually see in patients, according to these sources?
Right. So the main idea goes back to Warburg exploiting that glucose addiction, the induced hypoglycemia, the low sugar. It dramatically cuts off the cancer cell's primary fuel. The thinking is this weakens them, maybe stresses them out, making them much more susceptible to the chemo, even at those low doses.
And there was something in the case study about drug resistance, making the chemo work better.
Yes, exactly. A hypothesis they mention is that low blood sugar might reduce the energy, the ATP, that cancer cells need. See, cancer cells often have these pumps on their surface that actively push chemotherapy drugs back out of the cell. That's a big reason for drug resistance.
Okay.
If hypoglycemia cuts the energy supply for those pumps, maybe they stop working as well. So even a low dose of chemo stays inside the cell longer and does more damage.
Interesting. So starve them and maybe make them less able to defend against the chemo. What about actual results? The sources mentioned some consistent clinical observations, particularly around quality of life.
Yeah, this was really prominent across the sources, especially the case study and the team's comments. The most consistent benefit they reported seeing was significant pain reduction.
Pain reduction, that's huge for advanced cancer patients. Pain can be debilitating.
Absolutely. And they often saw it happen quite quickly, sometimes within the first few treatments. They even suggested a potential link visible on PEET scans. Tumors that were very active metabolically, taking up lots of glucose, which often correlates with being painful, showed much less glucose uptake after the therapy. And that seemed to track with patients reporting less pain.
Seeing that metabolic change on a scan line up with a patient feeling better, pain-wise, that's compelling.
It is. And beyond pain, that case study patient advanced lung cancer failed standard therapy. They noted other things important for palliative care. Better appetite, weight gain, less nausea and vomiting. Just generally improved quality of life alongside the metabolic changes and some tumor shrinkage seen on scans.
The video also touched on an immune system angle, didn't it? Something about the low-dose chemo.
Right. They floated this interesting idea. Because the chemo doses are low, they don't wipe out the patient's immune system like high-dose chemo can. So when some cancer cells are killed by the low-dose chemo, they break open and release tumor antigens. This could potentially act like an in-body tumor vaccine, helping the patient's own immune system recognize and target the remaining cancer cells. Plus, they theorize that reducing the lactic acid produced by fermentation, cleaning up that acidic tumor environment, might also help immune cells function better there. They even suggested it might be compatible with modern immunotherapy drugs.
So it's potentially hitting metabolism, boosting chemo effectiveness, and maybe enabling an immune response because it's less toxic overall. That adds quite a few layers.
It does. It suggests multiple potential mechanisms working together.
Okay, so looking forward then, what are the challenges? What needs to happen next, based on what the sources say?
Well, they acknowledge cancer is clever. Cells might adapt. If you cut off glucose, maybe they switch to burning other things, like glutamine or fats. So more research is definitely needed, perhaps looking at combination therapies to block those escape routes.
And what about further studies on this protocol?
The team is very clear. They want more support for low-cost approaches like this one. They'd love to see a large trial comparing it directly to standard care. But, they stress, given the lack of pharma interest and off-patent stuff, that kind of trial would probably need government funding or major philanthropic support.
And they also hinted that maybe focusing on a specific problem it seems good at solving, like cancer pain, might be a way forward.
Yeah, that was mentioned. If it could be clearly shown to be highly effective for something like severe cancer pain, where current options are often limited or have bad side effects, that might really get oncologists' attention and build momentum for wider acceptance or study. Address a clear, unmet need.
Right. Okay, so let's wrap this deep dive up. We went from Otto Warburg's almost century-old discovery about cancer metabolism, saw how it was sidelined, then rediscovered, and how it led to this specific low-cost therapy. We look at the safety data from that big study, which suggests it's feasible and safe despite the induced hypoglycemia.
Mm-hmm. And contrasted that with its truly remarkable affordability compared to standard cancer treatments.
And then we really dug into why, despite those points, it hasn't had the massive trials primarily, the sources argue, because there's no profit in it for the current drug development system focused on new patentable drugs, along with maybe some bias against things outside that system.
Exactly. And we touched on the observed benefits, like that significant pain reduction and the potential ways it might work, weakening cells via glucose restriction, possibly overcoming drug resistance, and maybe even helping the immune system.
It really leaves you with this striking paradox, doesn't it? Here's a potential treatment safe according to the available study, incredibly cheap, using known drugs, but it faces huge hurdles getting wider acceptance or rigorous testing, largely because it doesn't fit the economic model that drives so much of medical innovation.
Which brings us to the final thought for you, the listener, to chew on. What does this situation reveal about our current medical research and healthcare system? When a potentially valuable approach using inexpensive off-patent tools struggles to gain traction, what does that say about our priorities? How much does the potential for profit dictate which scientific ideas get fully explored and ultimately reach patients?
Something definitely worth thinking about. That's been the deep dive.